So we're reading today from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Leela, Chapter 3, series of verses from 76 to 85. And this is verse 76, okay? Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Sri Advaita Acharya said, "The amount of food that three people can eat does not constitute even a morsel for you. In proportion to that, these edibles are not even five morsels of food for you." So maybe a little context is required for this. I'll just read the previous two verses. So Advaita Acharya has just served an enormous feast. And Lord Chaitanya has recently taken sannyas, but he's been diverted to the house of Advaita Acharya. So he says, "I will not be able to eat so much food, and it is not the duty of a sannyasi to leave remnants." To which Advaita Acharya replies, in this connection, Advaita Acharya referred to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's eating at Jagannath Puri. Lord Jagannath and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu are identical. Advaita Acharya pointed out that at Jagannath Puri, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ate 54 times, and each time he ate many hundreds of pots of food. So this is why today he's saying that the amount of food three people can eat does not constitute even a morsel for you. So we'll read ahead till 85. This is text 77. Advaita Acharya continued, "By my great fortune, you have just come to my home. Please do not juggle words. Just begin eating and do not talk." Upon saying this, Advaita Acharya supplied water to the two lords so that they could wash their hands. The two lords then sat down and, smiling, began to eat the prasad. Nityananda Prabhu said, "I have undergone fasting for 3 days continuously. Today I hope to break my fast." Sri Sri Gaur Nitai Ki. Although Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was thinking that the quantity of food was enormous, Nityananda Prabhu, on the contrary, thought it not even a morsel. He had been fasting for 3 days and had greatly hoped to break fast on that day. Indeed, he said, "Although I am invited to eat by Advaita Acharya, today is also a fast. So small a quantity of foodstuffs will not even fill half of my belly." Advaita Acharya replied, "Sir, you are a mendicant traveling on pilgrimages. Sometimes you eat fruits and roots, and sometimes you simply go on fasting. I am a poor brahmana, and you have come to my home. Please be satisfied with whatever little foodstuffs you have received, and give up your greedy mentality." Lord Nityananda Prabhu replied, "Whatever I may be, you have invited me. Therefore you must supply as much as I want to eat." His Divine Grace Advaita Acharya, after hearing the statement of Nityananda Prabhu, took the opportunity presented by the joking words and spoke to him as follows. Advaita Acharya said, "You are a reject Paramahamsa, and you have accepted the renounced order of life just to fill up your belly. I can understand that your business is to give trouble to the brahmanas." Sri Advaita Acharya ki. This is the purport by Srila Prabhupada. There is always a difference of opinion between a Smartha Brahmana and a Vaishnav Goswami. There are even Smartha opinions and Vaishnav Goswami opinions available in astrological and astronomical calculations. By calling Nityananda Prabhu a Bhrashta Avaduta, a rejected Paramahamsa, Advaita Acharya Prabhu, in a sense, accepted Nityananda Prabhu as a Paramahamsa. In other words, Nityananda Prabhu had nothing to do with the rules governing Smartha Brahmanas. Thus, under the pretense of condemning him, Advaita Acharya was actually praising him. In the Avadhut stage, the Paramahamsa stage, which is the supermost stage, one may appear to be a Vishayi on the platform of sense gratification. But actually he has nothing to do with sense gratification. At that stage, a person sometimes accepts the symptoms and dress of a sannyasi, and sometimes does not. Sometimes he dresses like a householder. We should know, however, that these are all joking words between Advaita Acharya and Nityananda Prabhu. They are not to be taken as insults. In Karadaha, sometimes people misunderstood Nityananda Prabhu to belong to the Shakta Sampradaya, whose philosophy is Anta Shakta Bahi Savya Sabhayam Vaishnavo Mataha. According to the Shakta Sampradaya, a person called Gola Vaduta thinks materially while externally appearing to be a great devotee of Lord Shiva. When such a person is in an assembly of Vaishnavas, he appears like a Vaishnava. Actually, Nityananda Prabhu did not belong to such a community. Nityananda Prabhu was always a brahmachari of a sannyasi of the Vaidika order. Actually, he was a Paramahamsa. Sometimes he is accepted to be a disciple of Lakshmipati Tirtha. If he is so accepted, Nityananda Prabhu belonged to the Madhva Sampradaya. He did not belong to the Tantrika Sampradaya of Bengal. Srila Prabhupada ki. Om Gyanati Miranda Singhana Janashalakya Chakshan Militam Venatas Mishri Ingramanam Om So this is a very interesting, it's a very interesting chapter actually, all centered around Lord Chaitanya and the wonderful dealings he has with his devotees. Mahaprabhu has, in this chapter, essentially taken sannyas and started traveling. And he wanted to go to Vrindavan. But Nityananda Prabhu diverted him. He tricked him. He enlisted the help of some cowherd boys who were there, and they tricked him and told him that the river Ganga was actually the Yamuna. And then somehow or other, they brought Mahaprabhu to Advaita Acharya's house, where this episode is taking place. And Advaita Acharya obviously had prepared, his wife had prepared an enormous feast, a very large, comprehensive meal. But Advaita Acharya petitioned the Lord and said, "I've only prepared a simple meal for you. Please come and honor." So here we have some interesting dimensions to the whole process of receiving, hosting guests, and also the needs of the guests themselves. I don't know how many of you have been to house programs where devotees lovingly invite you, and then they feed you enough so that you can barely get into the car at the end of the program. Probably most people have experienced it. But when the invitation is made in such a loving way and someone is petitioned with, "Have some more, have some more, have some more," it's very difficult to refuse. So all of Lord Chaitanya's associates, they try this with Lord Chaitanya. Because they know that when a supreme Paramahamsa or the Supreme Lord himself comes to the house of a Grihastha, that is the greatest opportunity for them to serve such a saintly person. So they make the most of it. They go all out, as we say. The entire day is spent cooking, preparing. And then they offer this wonderful feast to their guests. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, of course, was quite selective. He would only eat food cooked by brahmanas. In other places, there would be other methods. Traditionally, the grihasthas would offer different bhoga items to a traveling mendicant. And then they themselves would do the cooking. And then after they've done the cooking and offered it, then everyone in the house would take of that prasad. So it's interesting how to maintain standards for a sannyasi in particular. So we don't follow those so strictly today. But definitely there is some discrimination required into where someone eats and whose house and the standards that are available there. But in this particular example, there are lots of food. There's lots of food on three plates, which is set up. And Advaita Acharya's intention was that one of those was for offering to Krishna. It was a metal plate. And then the other two were banana leaves. And there were two portions on those, one for Lord Chaitanya and one for Lord Nityananda. So when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was invited into the room along with Nityananda Prabhu, and they saw this, they thought, okay, these are all for Lord Krishna. And so then they requested two additional plates for them to take, the remnant. But Advaita Acharya's intention was that actually Mahaprabhu is the Supreme Lord himself. offering a portion to Mahaprabhu directly is equivalent to offering to Krishna. And hence he's made this point that in Jagannath Puri, you in your form as Jagannath, you eat 54 times a day, I think it is. Is it 54? Yeah. 54 times. So of course we know how Bhaktivinoda Thakur very much wanted to reinstate that, because standards had dropped in the intervening years. So then he set this system up very strongly, and it's continuing very systematically today even. And so there's plenty of prasadam at Jagannath Puri. And then it's all that prasadam is available for pilgrims to purchase outside. And when most people go to Jagannath Puri, having Jagannath's prasadam is one of the main, if not the main activity they do. Because Jagannath is, he eats a lot, he's very merciful. And then from there, all that prasadam is offered to Parvati, to Durga Devi, and then it is given to the pilgrims. So it's a very nice system. So here we have a little hint of the Shakta aspect, that in Bengal in particular, there is a lot of worship of Durga Devi, Durga Chandi, this is, mode of worship is not quite the Vaishnav style of worship. Various items are used which are considered impure. And the aim of this type of Shakti worship is for material prosperity, material progress. Now you find worship for material progress anywhere in the world. It's everywhere. All regions of India have it, all countries of the world have it. People generally worship for the sake of some material gain. Sometimes they worship for the sake of saving themselves from distressing situations, if they want knowledge, if they want realizations, it says in the Gita. So it's a common principle that people worship for the sake of something material. So that is the underlying principle behind Shakti worship, the worship of Durga Devi, or indeed Lord Shiva. For most people, when they worship Lord Shiva, it's a type of demigod worship, and therefore it's classified as demigod worship to worship Lord Shiva, even though we know Lord Shiva is not a demigod, and even though he's in a sort of category well beyond demigod. He's not an ordinary jiva at all. He's practically Vishnu himself. Yet when people relate to him in a mood of, I'm going to offer this to you, please give me something, that is classed as demigod worship. So there is a lot of that going on, and as Prabhupada indicates, there is always a conflict between the worshippers of Shakti and the worshippers of Lord Vishnu, because both are after different things. Actually, the motivations of the Shakti worshippers could just as well be dovetailed in the worship of Vishnu, because it is explained in the Shastras, in the Bhagavatam, that whatever desires one has, whether one desires a lot of material prosperity, whether one has no desires, or whether one has desires for liberation, one should actually worship the Supreme Lord. Tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. That is considered the worship of a broad-minded individual, that one should worship the Supreme Lord exclusively at all stages of one's life. So there is always this this slight conflict. And it's not really a conflict in the sense that both parties are trying to worship a superior authority for fulfilling their desires. Now we know that the supreme authority is Lord Krishna, and the bona fide way to worship him is to worship him through his bona fide parampara, through the persons he has put in place to disseminate spiritual knowledge. So that's the correct way to actually worship for ultimate human progress. But the fact is that most people in this world are not after ultimate human progress. They're after some temporary results. They're after something that makes them feel good. Sometimes it's literally as basic as, I just want to feel good. And of course, that really is sense gratification. The desire to feel good comes from the contact with the senses. But as we know, as devotees, after we've heard a little wisdom from Srila Prabhupada, after we've spoken to devotees, we know that yehi samsparsha cha bhoga dukkha yonaya evate. We know that contact of the senses with the objects leads to misery. We know it does not bring us anything lasting or substantial. In the short term, it brings us some happiness. It brings us some satisfaction, maybe a sense of life's good. But it always and without fail inevitably ends up being troublesome. Dukkha yonaya evate adiyantamanta konteya nateshu ramate buddha. It always ends in some type of misery, some type of dukkha. So although we know this as a philosophy, it is very difficult to practice it. It's very difficult for anyone to practice it. So someone like Lord Chaitanya, as a sannyasi, he's putting special restrictions around himself to make sure that there is no chance that he might inadvertently engage in sense gratification. So typically someone will do that. Someone who adopts the renounced lifestyle to whichever category or level that they can, they have to put in place some boundaries to protect them and give their growth some channeling. So that is what devotees do, and that is what Lord Chaitanya is doing here. Because the aim is to be focused on worshipping Vishnu, and then worshipping Vishnu not in the first category, which is to desire something material from him, but rather to worship him for the sake of wanting to serve him and please him. Just bring satisfaction to him without any other motivations. And so therefore you have the conflict. It's a conflict of motivation, and then the conflict of motivation between Shakti and Vishnu results in a conflict between the type of practice. So then the practices are also very much more in the mode of ignorance. The items offered are not pure items. Liquor is offered, meat is offered, things like that, when someone attempts to worship in the lower modes. So that leads to conflicts, because some people never consider the philosophy, they just consider the external portrayals. They just consider the details of the ritual. So much squabbling in this world takes place on the basis of difference of ritual. You know, so many faiths. And then within the faiths even, different divisions are formed, all coming from the same original root. It's there in every single religion. There are different branches which are formed. And then on the basis of a slight difference of practice or detail of the ritual, people fight tooth and nails, like cats and dogs, you can say, over nothing. Most of the explanations that are followed by most people in most faiths are not substantially borne out by their original scriptures or the example of their original founder. Whether it's the prophet, whether it's the Lord himself, whether it's an ambassador, whether it's a teacher. Most people are not following the pure teachings of their original source. And yet they're squabbling as if their path is the only right one. So that squabbling goes on everywhere, and it's gone on here in the past. And so to portray a Vaishnava as being a Shakta, one who worships Shakti, would be considered an insult. And so some people, you know, obviously Nityananda Prabhu is a very very wonderful personality, very dynamic, very, very transcendental. And so they would like Nityananda Prabhu on their side, so there are some who are trying to portray him as being a Shakti worshipper. But of course we know, I mean, yesterday was Lord Nityananda's appearance. We know how his entire life was dedicated purely to the service of Lord Chaitanya. Lord Nityananda, of course, is quite old, quite a bit older than Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Nityananda himself he went on pilgrimage because a sage came to his father's house and asked him for his son as an assistant. And the same thing happened to Dashrath Maharaj, actually. And the sage came and requested Lord Ram to accompany him and assist him in his travels. So Lord Nityananda traveled quite some distance, traveled throughout India. And at one point he came to Pandharpur, which is in Maharashtra. And this is where it is referred here that he became a disciple of Lakshmipati Tirtha. Because Lakshmipati Tirtha was a great saintly person in Pandharpur. Now he's also the spiritual master of Madhavendra Puri, which is very interesting, which means that Lord Nityananda is his godbrother, but he considered him, obviously being an elder godbrother, he effectively treated him like a guru throughout his life. Now, it's interesting how it's all connected, because Madhavendra Puri's disciple is Ishwarapuri. And Ishwarapuri is the spiritual master of Lord Chaitanya. So, and Prabhupada doesn't describe this as a definitive fact, but he says, if he is so accepted as a disciple of Lakshmipati Tirtha, that makes him a member of the Madhva Sampradaya, not any Shakti Sampradaya. So in one sense you see that Lord Nityananda Prabhu's sort of initiation status is two levels higher than Lord Chaitanya. But he always accepted Lord Chaitanya as his supreme lord and master. So that is always amazing how these pastimes take place. And these persons, when saintly persons like Lord Nityananda and Lord Chaitanya appear in a sampradaya or in a vamsa, Surya Vamsa or whatever it is, Raghu Vamsa, then what they actually do, they don't really appear to take something from the sampradaya, from that parampara. They actually come to glorify that. And so it is said that when a great devotee appears in a line, that line is glorified. When Prahlad Maharaj appeared in that line of demons, that entire line was glorified. When Lord Chaitanya has appeared in this sampradaya, Lord Nityananda has taken shelter in this sampradaya, this glorifies the Madhva sampradaya very much. And of course the Lord can do anything he likes. So then we know how Lord Chaitanya took the two essential principles from each of the sampradayas and then formulated what we practice today. So that's some sort of historical detail that's included. But it does need to be just established, because there are a lot of discussions, misinterpretations, and there are so many branches of information about claiming to be authoritative about Lord Nityananda and even Lord Chaitanya. So different persons have written different books and different details, but especially Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj was very much focused on only sticking to authorized bona fide commentaries by bona fide devotees. And so we have different information which Prabhupada has obviously selected and used exclusively, information coming from bona fide sources regarding the histories of the Gaudiya Acharyas. And that is the way to stay safe, because not all of us have the capacity or capability even to conduct extensive research ourselves and to actually look at all the historical accounts, try and weed them out, go through them, compare and contrast, and decide which is bona fide. Most of us, or perhaps none of us, have that capacity to do that, because the ability to do that actually comes from empowerment and not from scholarship of any kind, not from Sanskrit scholarship, not from Bengali scholarship, not from any type of material education. So better we take the opinion of the opinion of our founder Acharya, opinion of our Acharyas, because that is the best way to be safe. So sometimes the analogy is given that if you're sick, well, one strategy is to go to the pharmacy, and look at all the bottles there with all their different labels and the colors, and just to try them all, to experiment. Just to say, okay, this one looks good. I like the color, marketing. Let me try it. But you know what will happen with that. You either make your problem worse. You may be lucky and you might cure it. There's a small chance you might discover a new cure which no one else has thought of, but it's highly unlikely. Most likely you will have wasted a great deal of time and maybe made yourself very sick. So far better to go to a doctor who will actually assess you, diagnose what the problem is, and then give you a prescription based upon their expertise. So that is really our process when we follow the teachings of Lord Nityananda Prabhu. We can read Lord Nityananda's activities here. They're very transcendental. He's an avaduta. He doesn't need to follow any norms. And there is a certain phase of his life when he definitely was in the strong avadut phase. And it was only really after Lord Chaitanya, this is part of Lord Chaitanya's journey, and he's going to Puri. He's going to Puri after this, but then he goes on a tour of South India, and so during that time, Nityananda Prabhu has been deputed to head up the preaching in Puri. And so Nityananda Prabhu does that, and he has good success with that preaching. Then Mahaprabhu comes back to Puri, and he sees things are going well, but he gets reports that the preaching isn't so much expanding in the Bengal area. the Mayapur area, the area where obviously he's from. So then he sends Nityananda Prabhu off there while he stays in Puri himself. And so Nityananda Prabhu starts preaching there. He does lots of preaching. He arranges the Panihati festival. He stays in this place called Karadaha, which is near Calcutta. And it said that's where, at that point, Nityananda Prabhu becomes a bit more regulated. He gives up the avadut feature to some extent. And at that point, he gets married and he does some extensive preaching. So Nityananda Prabhu has these phases he goes through. And if we were to read these verses, read these descriptions of Lord Nityananda and Lord Chaitanya, having these wonderful arguments, these wonderful back and forths, contradictions, or debates with Advaita Acharya, I mean, what happens next is more interesting, because Nityananda does some more wild stuff after this. So if we were to just read this and form our own opinions on this without understanding through the parampara what the purport of it is, we would probably make offense. We would certainly be misguided. We would probably take the subject matter very trivially. When we see two lords, three lords actually, Advaita Acharya is Mahavishnu himself, having these wonderful exchanges, and they seem very mundane in one sense, all about eating. This is all about eating and quantities of food. It can seem that, okay, this is the stuff I do every day. So let me perhaps try and take some lessons from this and implement some of those in my behavior. So then we might start throwing food around, as Lord Nityananda does a bit later. So it's always interesting how there are certain aspects of behavior which their lordships will demonstrate in all of their incarnations. And some of those are lessons for us. And some of those are not. And we need parampara guidance in understanding which of the behaviors are lessons for us and which ones are not. Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki. When we don't get that clear, we potentially end up in the Sahajiya line, where we look at certain pastimes. We look at this pastime of Lord Nityananda, Advaita Acharya, and we start to think, oh, it's okay. It's okay for a sannyasi to eat in this style. It's okay for them to behave like this. We may take certain lessons and think they apply to us. People may read the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam and consider, ah, Rasa Lila, that's good. Let's try some of that. And so much of the preaching of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, was to re-establish the actual true Siddhanta behind it. And this is why Prabhupada always explains, and especially in Kali Yuga, we need some extra boundaries and guidelines. In Bhaktivinoda Thakur had the job of re-establishing some credibility for Vaishnavas, actually, in Bengal. Because after Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu left, things started to degrade. A lot of Sahajiya mentality arose. And people were doing all sorts of things. And then the smarta aspect, the smarta Brahman aspect, also started to go into a different direction. There is nothing inherently wrong with smarta Brahmins. They are designed by the Lord. They're created by the Lord. Their basis, their source of information is supposed to be the Smriti, literature, the Vedas, even the Shruti. That's part of it. And through the Smarta tradition, the different Brahminical rituals, the traits, the explanations, the character, all of that is maintained. But when it starts to go wrong, and then people assume that due to membership of a lineage, they have a monopoly on the truth, then you have a big problem. So we have to make sure that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We don't just dismiss all Brahmanas, all Smarthas, as being useless. That's a great offense, because the whole thing has been created by Krishna himself. And he also says the Brahmanas are his heart, right? In various parts in the Bhagavatam. So Brahmanas are very special. But when things start to go wrong through degradation, through misinterpretation of philosophy, through taking it very casually, then you actually end up with a big problem. You end up with a deviation. And then spiritual principles are confused. different people start introducing things which they consider, that's a good idea. It makes me feel good, therefore I should do it. It was never done before in our history. It perhaps wasn't even done in recent memory in Prabhupada's time, since Prabhupada's time, say perhaps the last 40, 50 years, we're reaching a milestone in ISKCON, 50 years in ISKCON. But then we decide, okay, well now the world has moved on, so let's change a few things. Let's do a few things which were not instituted by Prabhupada. So this is always a tendency for everyone. This tendency is innate in everyone. But only when we read about the importance of being very, very strict and very loyal to parampara, do we stand any chance of defeating this when it comes. Because often we will make choices which seem very harmless. They seem very innocent. They seem, what's the problem with this? What is the problem? I don't understand. For so many years we didn't do this. Why don't we do this now? It's a great thing. It'll have this benefit. But we know, whenever something is introduced which does not have a shastric basis or a basis of precedent meaning something which has been done in the past by authorities. And these two guidelines are very useful guidelines for determining what is correct and what is not. An example is the Pandavas when they were in the forest and they're on their exile. They were faced with situations which they'd never conceived of in the past. Strange things. They had to make decisions which were not explicitly clear in Shastra. And so they would often ask the sages who would visit, what do we do in this situation? And then the decision would be made based upon, okay, what does it say in the Shastra? Are there any examples when such a similar event happened, such a similar situation? And then, okay, if Shastra doesn't have a direct corresponding story to tell on the subject, then, okay, let's look at the behavior of advanced devotees, of saintly persons, of paramahamsas, great acharyas. What decisions did they make in similar circumstances? So that's precedent. And you have this in law as well, where, okay, there may be the law, but then there is precedent. How did a ruling go in the past? And then future cases often have to follow the precedent set in the past, even if it may not be explicitly encoded in law. So that is a good strategy for us to follow also. What is in the law? What is in our Shastra? What does Shastra say we should do? And okay, if there are no direct, clear guidelines on it, what is the behavior of other saintly persons? What is the mood with which saintly persons conduct themselves? When Prabhupada made decisions on so many areas, so many different aspects, what were the decisions he made? What were the underlying principles behind them? That's a very useful way to make a decision. Not just it feels good. Because as we've said, that is no basis for making a decision for a spiritually progressive person. That is the basis for a group of persons who want to just be happy, who want to create a society where they can have fun. Basically a social club. I mean, there are so many clubs in the world, so many organizations, so many groups. Why? Because people come together and they like to be happy. So they'll adopt some kind of constitution, they'll adopt some kind of this, that, and they'll make rules, they'll make activities that they do, they'll have hobbies that they all share. So it's not the case that only when you come to spiritual life do you have a community environment where you do things together for the purpose of feeling happiness in Krishna. People do this just without Krishna every day of every year around the world. But their motivations are material, and their motivations are based on what makes me feel good. So we have to be very, very resistant to this. In practice, in most people's lives, we typically don't need to make too many decisions. Or we typically don't need to make too many fundamental decisions, let's say. Certainly, that's one of Prabhupada's strengths, that he didn't feel he was authorized to change any of the fundamental principles that the previous acharyas had exemplified, demonstrated. And those acharyas are following the principle that what is coming from the Lord is bona fide and genuine. So that is a trait of our parampara. Prabhupada so many times spoke against people creating their own ideas. He said one time, in the West you like to change. You keep wanting to change something. You can't just remain steady and fixed on a particular path or direction. You keep having to change something. So that's actually a type of disease. It is part of the Kali Yuga mentality of being disturbed. You know, Kali Yuga has so many special features it offers us. Prayana alpayusha sabya kalao asmin yuge jana manda sumanda matayo manda bhagya hyupadrita. That one is dull, one's mental capacities are low, one is short-lived, and one is always disturbed. So that means that our minds are never steady. They're flickering. We need to get more to the stage of samudra mapa pravishanti yadva, that the rivers are coming into the sea, into the ocean, but the ocean is steady, equipoised. So in practice, most of us don't need to be concocting reinventing the principles of spiritual life. They've already been given to us. They've been given to us on a plate, on a large plate of 18 volumes of Srimad Bhagavatam, 12 cantos, then so much knowledge from Chaitanya Charitamrit, 700 verses of the Gita with elaborate purports. It's all there. We don't have to try to put a new spin on it. We can just take it and we can try to deeply understand it. Because if we don't do that, when we follow the direction that I will do what makes me feel good, you end up with deviant sampradayas. And then that's a big mess. Because once an institution is running, and once there is a certain body, a certain level of widespread acceptance, then often many things are done just routinely, mechanically. Because most people do not always think about Shastra. Most people do not, even though they may read Shastra, they do not in-depth meditate on it and try to scrutinizingly understand it. And of course, the capacity to do so also depends on one's innate capacities. And not everyone has that. So then people use Shastra and they will produce their own interpretations from it. So therefore, we need these fences in place. That Shastra and the interpretations of Shastra, they are determined and expressed by advanced acharyas. Our duty is to subserviently follow those acharyas and understand how to implement Shastra in my life. So then we know which of the examples of Lord Nityananda do we consider as lessons for ourselves? Which of the behaviors of Lord Chaitanya should we follow? Which of them should we leave as the prerogative of the Supreme Lord who can do anything he wants at any time? That requires parampara intelligence. That requires guidelines from Srila Prabhupada. And then in an immediate way, it requires guidelines from our own spiritual masters. And then the temple authorities and so forth. So we always have a system whereby information is made more and more specific and tailored to each person through the help of various advanced persons. So that's the sort of tattva aspect. But a lot of the discussion here is about the wonderful prasadam pastimes. And they're always fun. What we get with this type of description is a little rasa amidst all the immense philosophy that's presented in the CC. We get a little insight. We actually get to almost spy. We get to spy on how the avadutas and the Supreme Lord and his manifestations conduct themselves. Now that's a great privilege because, you know, just as you can't just peep in to see what the Queen is doing or what the President is up to right now, it's somewhat private. We don't naturally have a right to know what the Lord does. But only through the mercy of Vrindavan Das, Thakur, Krishnadas, Kaviraj, and so forth, and Prabhupada, we get to see how Lord Nityananda, Lord Chaitanya are invited to Advaita Acharya's home. Lord Chaitanya is in one direction. I'm eating too much, give me less. Lord Nityananda is in another direction. I've been fasting for 3 days, I'm hungry, give me more. It's fun. It's nice to see how these interactions, relationships, these pastimes take place. And then you have Advaita Acharya who's somehow trying to diplomatically make both of them happy. He has to encourage Lord Chaitanya and say, look, don't worry, it's nothing. It's nothing, it's just a small amount. You won't compromise your sannyas principles if you come to my house and eat. And to Nityananda he says, look, just remember who you are. You're a Paramahamsa, you're not meant to be eating so much. I mean, who but Mahavishnu can dare to offer that advice? I mean, some of the words are quite interesting. He says, you are a reject Paramahamsa. quite a chastisement, no? Give up your greedy mentality. But then, of course, there are explanations for all of those. And so, with the Lord's pastimes, the acharyas will be able to find from each and every episode that takes place some lesson, whether it is along the direction of the story or not. One example is in the Gita when Arjuna is lamenting at the beginning. And he's gone through a whole history of how when tradition is destroyed, irreligion arises, principles are lost, family tradition is vanquished, people get corrupt, unwanted progeny appears. He's gone through all of that. And then he says, I don't want to fight. And so Prabhupada says, now of course, that stance of Arjun from the point of view of the storyline of the Gita was not the completely correct stance. Krishna then spent the next 17 chapters trying to correct that stance and said, no, actually the correct thing for you to do is to fight, not to not fight. So, but there's an interesting insight that Arjun's behavior, Prabhupada describes as being the behavior of a kind-hearted person, that he doesn't want to kill. So even if in the Bhagavatam, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the CC, there are certain behaviors which are not directly going towards the end conclusion, such as Arjuna's refusal to fight, or for instance, Nityananda Prabhu wanting a lot to eat, still the acharyas will draw something from there which is useful in a different context. So one additional principle which I would like to include, that is a useful principle when discussing these type of things, is to understand within which contexts we apply which lessons. If you apply concepts of tattva in an environment where lila is a predominating activity, it doesn't always work. You'll get this type of thing going on. There's a whole lila of eating going on here. A whole lila of accepting what Advaita Acharya, his wife, has made and actually having their lives be perfected by the Supreme Lord accepting their prasadam. But at the same time, there are so many lessons here for how a Paramahamsa should behave. There are so many details here of how one should fast. I mean, Nityananda wants to eat a lot now, but let's not forget the fact that he's just been fasting for 3 days. So most people who would like to feast, they don't necessarily do the first thing. So we have to look at each and every detail, and then even logically we can come to a type of understanding which glorifies the person's in the pastime. Even without so much direct input from parampara at that point. Just from a point of logic, we can actually appreciate how things work. There are so many reasons why Lord Krishna's dancing with the gopis could not be considered immoral. Yes, morality is judged according to so many modern principles. And what is moral and what is not alters as time goes on. Now, just from a point of logic, if we consider the tattva of Lord Krishna's position, the gopis, their desires, Lord Krishna's desires, the whole interchange, we could not come to the conclusion that there was anything inappropriate. Yet there are so many people who will propagate this, that this was inappropriate. Krishna's dancing with these girls, it is totally inappropriate. Immoral act, they call it. Well, that's the problem. They've not understood the tattva. They've not understood the lila. And they've not understood when to apply which bit of tattva to which part of the lila. So even if we read something in Shastra, we have to be very careful that we use it correctly within its correct context. If we have a certain agenda that we are trying to propagate, and then we go hunting through the Gita, through the Bhagavatam, through CC, and we finally come across a verse. Ah, this verse supports what I want. And then we portray as the substance behind my argument. You will confuse or gain the acceptance only of others who do not scrutinize the literatures. That type of argument will never work for someone who deeply scrutinizes the literatures and understands a lot more than just the one example you've quoted, or understands a lot more about the context within which each example should be applied. So it's a question of which presentation do you want for which audience? If you have a group of people who are not solidly versed in Shastra, it is quite easy to produce a few statements of Prabhupada, a few statements from Krishna, a few statements from his devotees, and make some kind of case and present it, which will be accepted within a group of individuals who are not well-versed. That's not so difficult to do. It is far more difficult to have a very legitimate stance presented before a group of individuals who do know in depth. Then it is highly unlikely that anything that deviates will be accepted. So our duty for all of us, and each person has a different capacity with this, is to scrutinizingly study Shastra to the maximum extent that we are capable. Then also to have a degree of humility and understand that it is not through academic scholarship that we will understand Shastra. It is not through acute intelligence that we will actually understand Shastra. It is through the mercy of the Lord. So we should, as much as possible, go into the details of Shastra, look at the different circumstances, look at the different situations, understand why did the Lord do this under this case? Why did Prabhupada say this was permitted in this circumstance, but not permitted in the other circumstance? Why did he do that? Then when we have to make a decision on important matters, we will do so correctly. So that sort of followed naturally from this contradictory behavior of the Lord's. And how Prabhupada actually goes through, he actually says specifically, he says, these are all joking words between Advaita Acharya and Nityananda Prabhu. They are not to be taken as insults. So that's the clear line for us. That don't just go by what you're reading. The actual purport is that these are interactions happening in a different context to yours. So don't try and imitate them. So I'll stop there.